Books on Tape presents Audition, a memoir by Barbara Walters, read by Bernadette Dunn. Prologue. Sister. I thought for a while that is what the title of this memoir should be, because it was my older and only sister, Jacqueline, who was unwittingly the strongest influence in my life. Jackie was 3 years older than I, but all our lives she appeared younger. My sister was mentally retarded, as the condition was called then, though only mildly so, just enough to prevent her from attending regular school, from having friends, from getting a job, from marrying. Just enough to stop her from having a real life. Her condition also altered my life. I think I knew from a very early age that at some point Jackie would become my responsibility. That awareness was one of the main reasons I was driven to work so hard. But my feelings went beyond financial responsibility. For so many years, I was embarrassed by her, ashamed of her, guilty that I had so much and she had so little. Very little was understood about retardation almost 80 years ago when Jackie was born. There were few schools that dealt with what we now call the intellectually impaired, few workshops where they could go and learn a trade, few employers who would figure out how to use their talents and their loyalty. Today, Jackie could probably get a job, something simple but productive. She might even have met and married a nice man. But back then, Jackie's life was essentially one of isolation, except for the relationship she had with me and my mother and father. My parents protected her. They never discussed her outside the family or explained her condition to anyone. People wouldn't understand, they felt, and Jackie would be shunned and humiliated. Jackie's isolation also contributed to my own sense of isolation. As a child, I didn't have birthday parties because Jackie didn't. I didn't join the Girl Scouts because Jackie couldn't join. I rarely had friends over to the house because they didn't know what to make of my sister, and I would hear the whispers, real or imagined. When I was older, my mother, heartsick at Jackie's loneliness, would often ask me when I was going out with a girlfriend or on a date with a boy to take her along. I loved my sister. She was sweet and affectionate, and she was, after all, my sister. But there were times I hated her, too. For being different, for making me feel different, for the restraint she put on my life. I didn't like that hatred, but there's no denying that I felt it. Perhaps you'll be horrified at my admission. Or perhaps you're guilty of some of the same emotions and will feel relief that you are not alone. I imagine, as I write this, that almost anyone who has a sibling who is chronically ill or mentally or physically impaired will understand what I mean. I recently came across a book that helped explain a lot about the impact Jackie had on my life. It's called The Normal One, Life with a Difficult or Damaged Sibling, written by Jean Safer, a psychotherapist who grew up with a very difficult brother. I recognized myself on almost every page. The prematurely mature child, the looming responsibility for a sibling's care and well-being, the compulsion to be an overachiever, the fear of failure. I wish I had read the book earlier in my life, but I'm not sure it would really have made a difference. Jackie would still have been Jackie, and the same set of circumstances would have driven my life. Much of the need I had to prove myself, to achieve, to provide, to protect, can be traced to my feelings about Jackie. But there must be something more. The something that makes one need to excel. Some may call it ambition. I can live with that. Some may call it insecurity, although that is such a boring common label, like being called shy, that means little. But as I look back, it feels to me that my life has been one long audition, an attempt to make a difference and to be accepted. My sister was a very pretty child. Her mental condition had nothing to do with her physical appearance. She was fair-haired, fair-skinned, with a sweet smile, shorter than I, curvier than I. I had dark hair, a sallow complexion, I was often told, and was skinny. Skinny Malinkydink was what my parents lovingly called me. Yes, it was meant lovingly. You wouldn't have known by looking at Jackie that there was anything different about her until she opened her mouth to talk. Jackie was the worst stutterer I have ever known. She stuttered so badly that sometimes when she was trying to get a word out, her tongue protruded from her mouth. My parents tried almost every technique available to help her as she was growing up, but nothing seemed to make a difference. At one point, they even took her to see the man who supposedly helped Britain's King George VI get over his speech impediment. He couldn't do anything for my sister. It was frustrating to listen to her. It was hard to be patient and easy to mock her. My first memory of my sister is when I was about 3 and Jackie 6. The boys in the neighborhood were pulling at her skirt and making fun of her because they'd heard her talk. We both ran crying into the house. Until Jackie died from ovarian cancer in 1985, I worried about her, supported her, made decisions for her that my parents couldn't make, and agonized over the fact that although I couldn't always love her, she always loved me. She taught me compassion and understanding. In later years, these feelings would be important to me in interviewing. Often frustrated herself, often cranky and prone to tantrums, she never expressed resentment or jealousy of me. When my daughter was born, I named her Jacqueline, Jackie. I wanted the grown Jackie to feel that she, too, had a child, because I knew by this time she never would. So yes, though I had mixed feelings about my sister, I do believe the love was stronger than the resentment, and the sympathy for her was overwhelming. I tell you all this because young people starting out in television sometimes say to me, "I want to be you." My stock reply is always, "Then you have to take the whole package." They laugh politely, not knowing what I'm talking about, and I don't elaborate. I've guarded my sister's privacy for years, and though she was the central force in my life, she was part of the package that I'm about to unwrap on these pages. That package also includes my brilliant and mercurial impresario of a father, my loving but frustrated and conflicted mother, the amazing and celebrated people I met from childhood on, and my professional career in television. Oh, that. But mostly, this memoir is a personal story about how and why I got from there to here. Before I end this prologue, let me tell you a story. Back in the 60s, when I was appearing daily on NBC's Today Show, I was living on 7th Avenue and 57th Street. My apartment was across from Carnegie Hall and on the corner of a very busy street. It was also near several large hotels that catered to businessmen. Perhaps because of this, the corner was the gathering place for some of the most attractive ladies of the evening. Each morning at 5 o'clock, I would emerge from my building wearing dark glasses as I hadn't yet had my makeup done, and I was usually carrying a garment bag. It seemed obvious to the ladies that there was some big number I had just left. Now bear in mind that even then I wasn't exactly a spring chicken, but I would emerge and look at the young ladies, some of whom were still teenagers. "Good morning," I would say. "Good morning," they would answer. And then I would get into this long black limousine with its uniformed driver, and we would glide off into the early morning light. And you know what effect all this had on the ladies? I gave them hope. Perhaps this book may do that for you. So here it is, the whole package, from the beginning. Lou, Dina, and my princess grandmother. My mother, Dina Seletsky, met my father, Lou Walters, at a charity dance in Boston in 1919. They were introduced by a friend of my father who would later marry my mother's sister. My mother was 22 and quite striking, with long black hair, high cheekbones, a big bosom, too big, she always thought, great legs and lovely brown eyes through which she could barely see. She was dreadfully nearsighted and always wore thick glasses, the bane of her existence. Whenever she posed for pictures, she took them off. My father, then 24, was not especially good-looking. He was short, about 5'7", slight of build, and had light brown hair and a prominent nose that he would later have surgically reshaped. He, too, wore glasses, but had a different problem with his sight. He had a glass eye, having lost one of his eyes from the shards of a shattered milk bottle in a childhood accident. But he was always impeccably dressed and had a certain elegance, probably because he had grown up in England. He had an English accent, very appealing, then as now. He was also well on his way to making his first fortune. My father was in the business many people envied, but rarely dared enter, show business. He opened his own booking company, the Lou Walters Agency in Boston, around the same time that he met my mother. Vaudeville was king in the prosperous post-World War I giddiness known as the Roaring Twenties, and my father owned the keys to the kingdom, at least in New England. Vaudeville halls were packed with people who never stopped partying, and my father kept the party going. He wanted flappers? The Lou Walters Agency had them. He wanted a Charleston band? No problem. Magicians, dancers, comics, big stars, little stars, my father had them all. The money was pouring in. He was only in his 20s. My mother, on the other hand, was working in a men's neckwear store, wrapping packages. Not much of a career, but her father, who was in the shoe business, had heart trouble, and she was helping her parents support the 6 younger kids. My mother, I am told, always seemed above her job. She, too, had a certain elegance that set her apart from most of her friends. She spoke beautifully and had a good, if slightly caustic, sense of humor. My parents married a year after they met. May 30th, 1920, is the date that officially began their often tortuous relationship, one that somehow lasted for nearly 60 years and survived personal tragedy, the heights of success, and the depths of financial ruin. On paper, they seemed ideally suited for each other. Each was a member of what seems now to be a huge family, 7 children. Each was a child of immigrant parents whose journey from persecution in the old country could be the history of thousands of Jewish refugees transforming their lives in America. Both sets of my grandparents came from what was then part of the Russian Empire and is now Eastern Europe, my mother's family from a village in Lithuania, and my father's family from Lodz, Poland. This discovery would have startled some members of the family who firmly believed my father's superior side of the family came from the scholarly and highly religious city of Vilnius, known as the Jerusalem of Lithuania. I'm no genealogist. My cousin Shirley was the self-appointed historian of the Walters family until her death in 1997, and she always claimed their superior Vilna connection. But the old records I found while researching this memoir show the 1868 birth of my paternal grandfather, Isaac Abrahams, in Lodz, and the birth of my maternal grandfather, Jacob Seletsky, at about the same time in Russia. Both the Seletskys and the Abrahamses are thought to have joined the flood of Jews fleeing anti-Semitism in Imperial Russia. By the 1890s, my mother's side of the family seems to have immigrated directly to America, where they settled in Boston. My father's side of the family went to London. My cousin Shirley loved to tell the fairy tale of how my paternal grandfather met and subsequently married my grandmother. In Shirley's version, Isaac Abrahams, then around 22, arrived in London orphaned, uneducated, and penniless. He somehow met a well-off family named Schwartz, who had left Eastern Europe some years before, and by then owned several highly profitable knitting mills in England. Mr. and Mrs. Schwartz, impressed by Isaac's intelligence, manners, and good looks, more or less adopted him, giving him a job as an apprentice in one of the knitting mills, and educating him as well, starting with teaching him English. Enter their daughter Lillian. Every fairy tale has to have a princess, and Lillian, their only daughter, more than filled the role. On holidays, her parents sent her to the knitting mills, with baskets of food, turkeys, geese, ducklings, bread and cakes, for all the apprentices. On the fateful day the princess first laid eyes on the handsome orphan, according to Shirley, Lillian was wearing a pale blue coat and a little white ermine muff and hat. It was love at first sight, forbidden love, the best kind. The plucky princess followed her heart and, ignoring her family's orders to give up this penniless suitor, eloped with Isaac. The Schwartzes weren't thrilled with this marriage, but they had trained Isaac well in the mills, and he became a prosperous custom tailor in London. And the princess became a mother, 7 times. First Rose, my cousin Shirley's mother, then my father Lou, followed by Harry, Barnett, Rebecca, Belle, and Florence. Don't worry, there won't be a quiz. While Lillian and my grandfather Isaac were begetting my father's side of the family in London, my maternal grandparents were busy with their own begetting in Boston. My maternal grandfather, Jacob Seletsky, who started his life in the new country as a peddler, had gone into the shoe business with his brother Joseph when he met and married my grandmother, Celia Sakowitz, in 1895. They, too, produced 7 children. My mother, Dina, her sister, Lena, not much imagination in this family, and then a whole slew of sons, Edward, Samuel, Max, and twins, Daniel and Herman. I never did know my maternal grandfather, but I remember my grandmother, Celia, very well. She was short and stout, with thick glasses like my mother. Everybody listened to her. She was evidently strong and tough. She spoke English with a heavy Yiddish accent, and the few Yiddish words I remember, I learned from Grandma, like nebbish, meaning sweet but pathetic, or mishigas, meaning a whole lot of stuff going on, or meshuga, meaning crazy person, or farbissiner, a sourpuss. There must be better spellings of these words, but you get the drift. Unfortunately, my mother's side of the family did not have a historian like Shirley, so if there are any colorful Seletsky stories, I don't know them. The Schwartzes had educated my grandfather well, and Isaac became an avid reader and writer. He passed that passion for reading on to my father, whom I picture always with a book. Isaac also passed his talent for writing on to his eldest son. As a schoolboy in London, my father received a silver medal for academic excellence for an essay he'd written. Needless to say, my father was declared brilliant by his family. But Grandfather Isaac must have been having a difficult time in London. The clothing trade in the East End was notorious at the time for its abuse of immigrant Jewish laborers. The working conditions were beyond terrible, with low-paid employees, many of them children, jammed into hot, airless rooms with little or no sanitation 7 days a week. Such sweated labor, as it was referred to then, gave rise to the term sweatshop, and inevitably to social unrest and riots. I don't know if Isaac owned a sweatshop or worked in one, but it is believed that the bitterness and unrest in the clothing business, which spawned a strike in 1906, led him to pick up his family and relocate to Belfast in Northern Ireland. Though there was a sizable and growing number of Jewish immigrants there, the family didn't stay long. They immigrated to America in 1909. My grandfather Isaac and his 3 sons, my father, Harry, and Barnett, arrived in New York from Liverpool aboard the SS Cedric on August 28th. According to the passenger manifest, they were detained overnight on Ellis Island because my father's loss of an eye required a doctor to certify his ability to enter the country. When they were released, they stayed with relatives, eventually moving to Rivington Street in a community of Jewish immigrants on Manhattan's Lower East Side. They were joined there 7 months later by my grandmother and the 4 girls who arrived on the SS Columbia. They, too, were detained overnight on Ellis Island until my grandfather came and picked them up, and my family's American odyssey began. It is not clear when or why the Abrahams family dropped Abrahams and renamed themselves Walters, but many immigrants at the time adopted English-sounding names to blend into the American melting pot. Two of my mother's brothers in Boston, for example, had already exchanged Seletsky for Selet. So my grandfather, Isaac Abrahams, became Abraham Walters. His princess wife became Lillian Walters, and their oldest son became Louis Edward Walters. Cousin Shirley, who along with her divorced mother lived for a while with my grandparents, would regale me later with stories about my very grand-grandmother. Lillian took a nap every day after lunch, slathered her face with Pond's dry skin cream, and put cold cucumber slices on her eyes. When I was older, I remember Shirley telling me before a date to lie down and put cucumber slices on my eyes. They dripped on the pillow. Lillian also took milk baths and erased any rough skin on her elbows with lemons. Although they were happily in the New World, my paternal grandparents remained British to the core. Sunday breakfast consisted of kippers and eggs and onions, and every afternoon my grandmother presided over a high tea with crustless watercress and cucumber sandwiches. So rooted were they in their British backgrounds that years later, the 1936 abdication of King Edward VIII to marry the twice-divorced American, Wallis Simpson, sent the whole family into paroxysms of grief. According to Shirley, my grandparents sobbed while listening to Edward's famous speech on the radio, giving up his throne for the woman he loved. Many years later, in some sort of divine family justice, my father would present a command performance of one of his shows to the Duke and Duchess of Windsor in the Bahamas, and he and my mother would join them for dinner. I never knew my father's parents. I was born around the time my grandfather Abraham died of a heart attack in 1931, at the age of 56. Lillian followed 5 years later. On the morning of the day she died, my princess grandmother asked Shirley to do her nails. "A lady should never live like this," she said to Shirley. "How could she die like this?" Then she proclaimed herself a virgin. To which Shirley naturally responded, "How could you be, Grandma? You have 7 children. But my grandmother had the last word. "I know," she said, "but I never participated." My father was 15 when he arrived on these shores and almost immediately started looking for a job. He wrote about that search much later when he was 70 in his unpublished treasure of a memoir, It's a Long Walk. He makes no mention of going to school in New York, which is sad. But then again, there was a newly arrived family of 9 to help support, and there were many more boys his age seeking jobs than there were openings. Every morning around 8 a.m., he wrote, he would begin that long 3-mile walk from Rivington Street in Lower Manhattan to Times Square. The want ads of the day, which he read every morning for months, were posted in the windows of a building at the corner of Broadway and 42nd Street. My father would rush over to the nearest address on the list, but he never seemed to get there first. Often there were 20 or 30 boys ahead of him, and soon another 20 or 30 behind him. When it was announced that the position was filled, he'd race over to the next nearest address, where by then there would be 40 boys ahead of him. It was hopeless, he wrote. It took him 7 months to land a job and, inadvertently, start his life's work. Office boy wanted, independent booking offices, 1440 Broadway, apply after 2 p.m. One of the want ads in the window read on the morning of April 5th, 1910. My father had no idea what a booking office did, but a job was a job, and after standing fruitlessly in line for several other openings, he wandered over to the office in the Knickerbocker Theater Building on the corner of 38th Street and Broadway. It was only noon. He knew he was early, but the months of frustration led him to inform the desk clerk that he had come to apply for the job. To his amazement, he was ushered in to see the boss, a Mr. Sturmdorf. It paid only $6 a week. Had he worked anywhere before? No. Could he type? No. And hadn't he read the after 2 p.m. for job applicants? That was at least a yes with my father's explanation that he was afraid of once again finding a long line and the job being filled before he got the chance for an interview. Mr. Sterndorf sent him packing and told him to come back at the designated time. My father was back at 2:05. The reception room was jammed with people, all of whom, he assumed, were looking for the office job, but actually were entertainers looking for work. And then the axe fell. "Sorry, the job's been filled," the desk clerk informed him. My discouraged father was halfway down the stairs when he realized the job couldn't have been filled before 2, so he went back. "Oh, you're Lou Walters, the one who came early," the desk clerk said. "Come in." Why did he get the job? Mr. Sterndorf, it turned out, was also British, and my father attributed his good fortune to their shared English accents. Personally, I think it was because my father showed such gumption, applying for the job not once but twice and making sure he was the first boy in line. He evidently learned the trade very quickly, submitting daily lists of the agency's clients to the bookers for chains of theaters and vaudeville halls. And so, for better or worse, he began his lifelong career in show business. It started off for better. One of the owners of the agency he worked for opened a branch office in Boston, and my father went along, as did his parents and all his younger siblings. It was in Boston that the Seletskys, my mother's side of the family, and the Walters, my father's side, began to converge. The Seletskys owned 2 shoe stores and were well established, and my paternal grandfather, Abraham, seems to have done okay there as a custom tailor. But for some reason, he decided Boston wasn't for him, and leaving my father behind, he moved the rest of the family to New Jersey, where some of the Walters family live to this day. My father did very well in Boston, and before too long, left to open his own booking agency, aptly named Lou Walters Booking Agency. He traveled to vaudeville halls in the smallest of towns. All towns had vaudeville halls in those pre-TV silent movie days, and found new acts, made contacts, traveled some more, found more acts. He discovered the comedian Fred Allen, then a juggler who went on to have his own hugely successful radio and television shows. He also discovered Jack Haley, another comedian, who later starred as the Tin Man in the classic film The Wizard of Oz. By the time my father met my mother, he had become the definition of a good catch. My father bought my mother a mink stole, and they moved into a 14-room mansion in Newton, a prosperous Boston suburb. My sister was born while they lived there. 2 years after my parents married, my mother's father died of heart failure, leaving my grandmother Celia with 5 children still at home to raise. My father immediately invited the entire family, including my mother's sister Lena, to live with them. When Lena married, she moved her new husband Sidney into the house. The house was large enough for everyone to live in comfortably, and they were able to get around in style. My father owned 4 luxury cars, 2 Cadillacs, a Pierce Arrow, and a Packard. I never saw any of it. My childhood. By the time I was born in Boston, I'm now in my 70s, and that is as specific as I will get, my father had lost his first fortune. The financial roller coaster of his business life would have an enormous impact on me. Throughout my life, my father made and lost several fortunes in show business. When I was growing up, most of the kids I knew had fathers who were in rather prosaic, safer businesses. My uncle sold shoes. My mother's brother-in-law sold cheap dresses. A big deal was to be a dentist, and the height of it all was to be able to brag about my husband, the doctor. Not a lot of people could brag about my husband, the booking agent. Certainly, my mother didn't, especially after their lives were turned upside down. It wasn't his fault. First of all, there was the stock market crash of 1929, which brought the Roaring Twenties, with all its luxury and indulgences, to an abrupt end. This was followed by the decade-long Great Depression. But what really doomed my father's business was an actor named Al Jolson. The Jazz Singer, starring Jolson, was released in 1927 and was a show business miracle. The pioneer talkie revolutionized the motion picture business. Not only did the era of silent films end almost overnight, but also, more gradually, did the market for live shows. As more and more vaudeville halls were converted into movie theaters, my father's once flourishing business sputtered. Therefore, I didn't go home from the hospital in Boston wrapped in my mother's fur stole, which by then had been sold, nor did I travel in one of the four cars, all of which were gone. Nor was I ensconced in a crib in the big house in Newton. Instead, I was brought to a modest two-family house in Brookline, also a suburb of Boston, but not nearly as grand as Newton. Still, it wasn't a bad place in which to grow up. Brookline, when I was a child, still had some fields where you could even see a horse or two. It had a small shopping center called, then and now, Coolidge Corner, with a bakery I remember still named Dorothy Muriel's, where you could buy yummy cupcakes. It also had one movie theater, and when I was older, I could walk there. The first time I went to the movies alone, I saw Daphne du Maurier's classic, Rebecca, in which the formidable housekeeper, Mrs. Danvers, burned down the ancestral home known as Manderley. I was scared to death and loved it. My father, meanwhile, had to close his agency in Boston because he couldn't pay the rent. He was reduced to selling acts or small shows to out-of-town theaters, which hadn't yet switched over full-time to movies. He also began to book banal industrial shows put on by organizations like the Massachusetts Shoe Manufacturing Association. Not very glamorous, but it helped pay the bills. When I was 5 or 6, my father had another mini-role of financial success. Though vaudeville was dead, the era of nightclubs had risen from the ashes, and he became an instant and talented nightclub producer. His first show, staged for a Boston club called the Lido Venice, featured a female impersonator from New York and what my father promoted as a chorus of lovely debutantes. Actually, they were young girls he'd recruited from local dancing schools. The first 2-week run was a smash. The second was over the top. My father persuaded Evelyn Nesbitt to appear at the Lido. She was the ravishing young woman whose affair some years before with the famous architect Stanford White had led her millionaire husband, Harry Thaw, to shoot White dead on the roof of Madison Square Garden. Nesbitt had only 2 accomplishments going for her, my father wrote later in his memoir. One was that her picture had been on the front page of the Police Gazette, as well as every newspaper in the country. The other was an ability to draw crowds, and draw them she did, reciting The Persian Kitten, a popular parody of the time, on stage to virtually every Bostonian, including the mayor and the chief of police. When my father was producing and directing these shows, he would often take Jackie and me to the rehearsals, where the performers would make a big fuss over us, the dancers would sometimes twirl me around until I got dizzy with pleasure. Then my father would take us for hot dogs on buns, which he loved, and so did we. But the good times didn't last. The Lido was sold, and though my father went on to produce a show at the Cascades Room in the Bradford Hotel, the ripple effect of the Great Depression caught up with him. The hotel chain that owned the Bradford went out of business. So, once again, did my father. He soon began, as they say, to take to the road. In search of business, he toured all over the eastern seaboard with a traveling road company of some 20 performers and musicians jammed into 4 cars. On the main car, there was a big sign that read, "Stop, Look, and Listen." At one point, he went hundreds of miles north with this moving caravan to Toronto and then to Nova Scotia to try to find a paying audience. Sometimes, we wouldn't see him for weeks. As a result, when I was a child, I barely knew my father. I have a vague memory of him coming back from one of these northern trips, carrying matching white coats with hoods for Jackie and me. They didn't fit, and my mother scolded him for wasting the money. My parents were, by now, an oddly matched couple. My mother was practical and somewhat depressed. She had a lot to be depressed about. Not only were there financial worries, but she had a child who was already being diagnosed as backward. Furthermore, 4 years before my sister's birth, my parents had lost a son. His name was Burton, and I was evidently named after him as both of our names started with a B. He died from pneumonia at the age of 14 months. I never heard my parents talk about him. But I remember when my grandmother died, I went with my mother to visit her grave. Next to it was a tiny gravestone that read, Burton Walters. My mother knelt and cried. So there were my mother and father, married with two young daughters. My mother, greatly loving to her daughters, but a practical woman without time for a lot of fantasy in her life. My father, just the opposite. A kind of poet who read all the time, seemed to live in his own head, and had a hard time showing affection. I don't remember ever trying to hug him, even after he came home from a long trip. My father's only escape throughout his life was playing cards. Mostly he played pinochle and gin rummy. He played for money, and usually lost, in part because a lot of his card-playing friends were in on the secret of his half-blindness, and it was said, would often discard to his fake eye to confuse him. But he was compulsive about playing cards. To keep him home at least one night a week, my mother agreed to have his card-playing sessions at the apartment, usually on Friday nights. His friends would come over, and the house would smell of cigar smoke for days. My mother, who never liked to play games, would nag him about his gambling and complain that he was risking much-needed money. I understood her insecurity and apprehension. I myself never liked to gamble, but it would take me years to appreciate my sensitive and gifted father and the extraordinary effort he made, in spite of the gambling, to support us during those hard times, only to be met at home with criticism. I do have some sporadic memories of my father taking my sister and me out and giving my mother some well-earned time off. Besides those wonderful rehearsals at the Lido Venice, he sometimes took us into Boston to ride on the swan boats in the public garden and to Boston's Chinatown for chicken chow mein. But those are rare recollections. I was very much my mother's daughter. She was so soft and loving to me. I used to tell her that when I grew up, I would buy her a beautiful house right next to mine. I never did. I can't tell you how much I wish I had. How did my mother truly feel about my father? I just don't know. She took good care of him and cooked all his favorite foods when he came home. Steak, French fried potatoes, made of course in those days from scratch, frankfurters and baked beans. She always gave my father the tenderest part of the steak. She brewed the tea he drank. She never used a tea bag. I know my father admired my mother's dignity and elegance. He often said so. She must have realized that his admiration meant he was sensitive and intelligent. He had not even graduated from high school, but he had read many of the classics, could quote from Shakespeare, and when he was home, read me to sleep with stories about Greek gods. To this day, I have a library of my father's books. They are almost all first or limited editions. But did they love each other? I can't remember my parents ever kissing in front of us or hugging or even having a laugh. Would they have stayed married today? I don't know. I only know they stayed married for nearly 60 years until death parted them. If my mother was judgmental about my father, he often said she saw the seams and not the satin, to Jackie and me, she was unfailingly kind and patient. If she and my father went out with friends, which was rare, she made sure we had the same sitter, an elderly, wiry woman nicknamed Dodie, who brought us soggy cookies she had made and herself smelled of cookie dough. Other than with Dodie, my mother never left us. She dressed both of us beautifully, sometimes alike, which I hated, put big taffeta bows, the fashion of the time, on our carefully brushed hair, cooked every meal herself, washed and ironed every day. In her spare time, she made wonderful hats for herself. I remember her sewing bright red cherries on a big black straw hat. She modeled it for us. I tried it on too, and it came down over my eyes. I was delighted. To be with my mother was my greatest pleasure, even though I was the recipient of her complaints, usually about my father. She didn't have many friends, mostly because she didn't play cards, or the later rage, mahjong, and she was afraid to drive. Her closest companion was her sister Lena, but Lena lived in another suburb, Dorchester, and had two young sons. She couldn't come to Brookline very often, although some Sunday she would drive over and pick us up to visit with her and my grandmother, who lived with her. But most nights, after she had cooked dinner, my mother, Jackie, and I sat at the kitchen table. My sister would sit silently, lost in her own thoughts, as I talked about my day at school. My mother, after listening and kissing me, would then often discuss my father, the lack of money, and his absence when she needed him. It did not seem odd to me that I was her confidant, but looking back now, I realize I was never young. We moved a lot in those days, usually down. At one point, we lived next to a funeral home. Another move took us to an apartment where, because my father was usually not there to help, my mother had to stoke the furnace in the basement. This hurt her back. My mother was sure things were going to get worse, and for a long time, they did. In those days, I thought that everybody had a sister who was mentally retarded, that all fathers gambled and were rarely at home. I knew that I had my mother's love, and I remember her often saying that she wished she had six of me. I was such an obedient and easy child. But in my mind then, it didn't seem like enough. Was I jealous of the extra time my mother spent on my sister, whose tears and tantrums she had to control, whom she often had to dress, whose hair she brushed and combed all of my sister's life? Did I want to be treated like a child and not another adult? I must have, because I remember often coming into my mother's bedroom when I was about 7 or 8 and whining about having a pain in my stomach. Since I was such a good child and rarely caused any trouble, she took these complaints very seriously. She would then leave my sister with Dodie and take me on rounds of visits to doctors who would examine me, take the needed tests, and find nothing wrong. But I continued to insist that I was in pain. After the doctor visits, Mother and I would stop off at a restaurant where I could order my favorite, spaghetti, bliss. Obviously, the stomach pains weren't affecting my appetite. Finally, one bewildered doctor said I should have my appendix taken out. It seemed the only choice. So I did, happily. More attention. When I got home from the hospital, I was even happier, because I was moved from my small bedroom in the back of the apartment, which was originally built to be a maid's room, into my parents' big bedroom overlooking a gas station. From their bedroom window, I could sneak peeks at the gas attendant. Every night after work, he closed the gas station and took off his overalls and stood in his underwear pulling on his pants. Exciting view for an 8-year-old. My incision became infected, causing my mother to lavish even more attention on me. How sweetly sad these memories are. One stands out. When I was in the hospital recovering from the operation, which in those days kept you in bed for almost a week, my mother would take the streetcar back and forth from Brookline to Boston every day to see me. She had to then walk a good 10 blocks to the hospital. One night, I heard someone entering my room, and thinking it was the nurse whom I didn't want to see, I kept my eyes closed. When the person left the room, I finally opened my eyes and saw at the foot of my bed my favorite doll. My mother, worried that I would feel alone, had taken the streetcar at night to visit me one more time. The memory has stayed with me all these years. I can barely write about it even today. It makes me so sad for her. Another view of my mother and me has also stayed so clear. a memory that goes back more than 60 years. One Christmas I remember saving money to buy my mother a cut-glass perfume bottle, which many women then kept on their dressing tables. My mother had a considerable collection, and I was sure she would want to keep adding to it. I carefully chose what I thought was the perfect one, chiseled in the shape of a half moon. I wanted my mother to love it and not want to return it, as she did so many of my father's gifts. She returned his present so often that he stopped buying anything for her. I have kept this lesson in mind all my life. No matter what anybody gives me as a gift, I say, "Terrific!" and wear it at least twice before trying to return it. The day before Christmas, unable to keep my secret totally to myself, I asked my mother if she would like another bottle for her collection. "Not really," she said. "I have too many already." I could barely keep back my tears, but it was too late. The next morning, I gave her my shiny wrapped present. She opened it, took me in her arms, and exclaimed, "Of all my perfume bottles, this is the most beautiful. It makes all the others look dreadful. I'm going to give them all away and only keep this one." And she did. By the way, none of these traumas, large or small, seemed to have affected my schoolwork. I was an overly serious student. I did my homework on time and got good grades. Someone once interviewed a few of my teachers at the Lawrence School, the small public school in Brookline that I attended. According to my fifth-grade teacher, Miss Mildred Gillis, I was a very serious pupil. She had given me an A, though she said she was usually stingy with her A's. She also said that I was delightful and a good writer. Where are you now that I need you, Miss Gillis? More revealing, perhaps, was her observation that she couldn't recall my having any playmates. "I don't remember Barbara as being social," Miss Gillis said. "School was a place of business for her." I disagree with that last pronouncement. I desperately wanted playmates, to have friends over to my house, to belong instead of always feeling like an outsider. When I was about 7 years old, the school put on a little performance for adoring parents. It featured a robin redbreast as the lead and a chorus of little brown-costumed chirpers. I was assigned the leading role of the robin. But here's the thing. I didn't want to be the star. I wanted to be in the chorus, to be like all the other kids. So to this day, I recall going home and watching my mother, who sewed very well, cheerfully making my robin costume. I tried it on with its big, gorgeous red belly, spread my wings, and burst into tears. When I told my mother why, she came to school with me the next day and explained the situation to the bewildered teacher. My mother and I went home, tore up the costume, and I became a chirper in the chorus like everyone else. My sister also went to the Lawrence School, but only briefly, and she didn't get to chirp at all. According to another interview, this with Elizabeth McGuire, the school nurse, Jackie was placed in the ungraded group, a euphemism for children with developmental disabilities. Jackie evidently had to repeat first grade at least once, and there is no record for achieving second. My poor parents. My poor Jackie. Also interesting to me was Miss McGuire's diagnosis of Jackie's condition as something usually caused by a birth injury. Years later, when my mother and I did talk about Jackie's condition, my mother thought that Jackie had been delivered by forceps, so Miss McGuire may have been right. Miss McGuire cited Jackie's lack of coordination, her unsteady gait, and her stuttering. Perhaps, she offered, Jackie suffered from a mild form of cerebral palsy. Later, Jackie was tested for this, but it didn't seem to be the case. We never did know what caused her condition. Now I wonder if it wasn't genetic. Would Jackie today be diagnosed as autistic? Two of my cousin's children have some form of developmental disabilities but live relatively normal lives. They are considered to be autistic. The word autism didn't exist when Jackie was young. Today, there are special treatments, diagnosticians, workshops, support groups. Most of all, there is understanding. But then, there was no place for my sister or my parents to go. Seeking guidance, my mother was often told to just send her away to an institution. That was never a consideration. For a short time, Jackie was enrolled in another public school called Devotion, which also had a program for the ungraded, but she didn't last long there either. She then stayed at home and had tutors who taught her to read and write, although I'm not sure at what level, as I never remember her being tested. I would guess third or fourth grade level. Nor do I know her IQ. She was home, always. My mother did her best not to make Jackie feel different. It usually didn't work. Once there was a neighborhood talent show. Jackie and I were taking tap dancing lessons, and my mother allowed us to enter the contest. She made us matching costumes, and off we went to perform. Well, Jackie got panic-stricken and forgot the few steps she had learned. She just couldn't follow the music, and finally, she simply stood there on the stage watching me. The audience booed. I was embarrassed and frightened. I took Jackie's hand, and we walked home to our mother. But was it a terrible childhood? A friend once said, when another pal was complaining about her childhood, "You didn't have a terrible childhood. Helen Keller had a terrible childhood." I had love. I never lacked for food or clothes. I had cousins with whom I happily played, especially in the summers. I had uncles who taught me to swim and took us to amusement parks. I had a mother and a grandmother who doted on me. I had a father who, although often absent, was never unkind or abusive. I did have a friend here and there. I remember one when I was about 10 with whom I smoked cigarettes stolen from her mother. So if I was a sad and serious little girl, I can't say that my early childhood package was wrapped in plain brown paper. It had some shiny paper, too, provided by occasional excursions into my father's unusual life, and it also had some pretty bows tied carefully by my mother. Skinny Malinky Dink. Over the years, as I was growing up, Mother, Dad, Jackie, and I would from time to time visit the Walters family in New Jersey. My Uncle Harry Walters was a leading citizen in Asbury Park, New Jersey, just over an hour from Manhattan. He and his wife, my Aunt Minna, owned a big dry goods store in Asbury Park. They sold sheets, towels, and even children's clothes. They did very well. When we visited, Uncle Harry would give us presents from the store. Uncle Harry and Aunt Minna had three daughters around my age. Sadly, all have died, but I do still see their children. My cousins had a governess, an honest-to-God governess. The sisters loved one another and played together. I never remember either of my parents setting foot in a temple. My father used to say he was an atheist, but Uncle Harry was very involved in the synagogue. He and Aunt Minna celebrated the Jewish holidays. They fasted on Yom Kippur and celebrated Passover with big feasts for the family. We never did. The closest we ever got was when my mother would light Sabbath candles on Friday night. Friday was the only night my father would make a special effort to be home. We certainly knew full well that we were Jewish, but practicing the religion just never seemed important. As a result, I have no Jewish education or any religious education and don't observe the holidays. One more thing about Uncle Harry and Aunt Minna. They seem to have a very good marriage. Everyone in the Walters family came to them for advice, comfort, and, oh yes, money. Uncle Harry headed the family. He was handsome, easygoing, sweet, and I guess predictable. His older brother Lou, my father, was adventurous, a gambler, an artist in his way, and definitely not a family man. I envied my three happy cousins. Talk about belonging. And yet, when we grew up, forgive me for saying this, my life was so much more interesting than theirs. Not necessarily better, but much more interesting. And for better or worse, I came to value interesting far more than normal. The Walters' side of the family always looked down on the more common Seletsky side, And, no surprise, my father never fitted in with the Seletskys, but we spent much more time with my mother's relatives. Every summer for about 5 years when I was a little girl, my mother, father, Jackie, and I shared a house with my mother's sister, Aunt Lena Alkin, her husband, Sidney, and their two sons, Selig and Alvin, in Nantasket. Nantasket, now a Boston suburban community called Hull, was, and is, a skinny peninsula 20 miles or so from Boston with Massachusetts Bay on one side and Hingham Bay on the other. It wasn't a swank summer resort like Hyannisport on Cape Cod, site of the home compound for the Kennedys, but I loved it, partly because I was with Selig, my hero, who was 5 years older than I, and Alvin, who was 2 years older and my best friend. Our house was smack on the main street of the tiny town, so all cars going in and out of Nantasket had to pass us. It was not a location most people would want, and it had just a small front yard and a porch facing the street. But all life passed by, and we felt very much in the swing of things. In addition, because it was such an unprivate and crammed piece of property, it was cheap to rent. In contrast to our quiet life in Brookline, the summers were busy and boisterous. Also sharing the house with us were my grandmother Celia, and at one time or another at least two or three of my uncles, all of whom had nicknames ending in Y or IE, uncles Sammy, Maxie, Eddie, Danny, and Hermie. There was only one bathroom, which we all used. Perhaps that is where I developed the bladder of a camel, something that would prove to be a huge asset in the countless hours I would spend live on camera. I cannot, however, attribute my other invaluable career asset to the Nantasket summers. I don't perspire. No matter how hot the television lights or how broiling the setting is, like the inferno of shooting for hours in the Saudi desert, for me, it is no sweat. The Nantasket beach was long and beautiful. The ocean was cold with big waves. We would get up each morning praying for a beach day, and while my mother or Aunt Lena was cooking or cleaning up after all of us, usually one or more of my uncles would walk with us the 6 very long blocks to the beach and help to teach us how to swim. There was no such thing as a swimming pool, it was straight into the waves. Some days my mother would come to the beach. I remember her in a one-piece black-knitted bathing suit that came down almost to her knees. She had those beautiful legs and that ample bosom. My mother wore her dark hair in a bun, but sometimes, coming out of the ocean, she would let down her hair and it spilled to her waist. I thought she was just gorgeous. My sister, usually holding on to my mother's hand, also had a lovely, round little body. Only I was all angles and bones, like a little dark spider. My nickname, as I've told you, was Skinny Malinkydink. If only someone would call me that name today, and mean it. Meals were cooked by my mother, the better cook, or Lena, the quicker cook, who was described by her son Selig as an Olympic-quality bad cook. But cooking anything in that kitchen was no mean accomplishment. It had an old coal stove you lit with a match and had to stoke constantly. The word icebox was also current in Nantasket, though by then there were millions of Freon gas-fueled refrigerators in the United States. Our house gave meaning to the Iceman cometh. And cometh he did, every day or so, lugging a new block of ice with giant tongs and putting it in the top of the icebox, where it kept the milk and eggs cool and dripped into a waiting basin. You could also chip off pieces of ice to dissolve on your tongue on sweltering days. Divine. Forget air conditioning. Never heard of it back then. Just open the windows. And listen in at night as the adults tuned in to their favorite radio programs, like Major Bowe's Amateur Hour, or ventriloquist Edgar Bergen, Candace's father, and his irreverent wooden companion, Charlie McCarthy. And of course, you could always hear my Aunt Lena. Aunt Lena didn't talk. She yelled. She used to terrify me when I was a child, but I later loved her almost as much as I loved my mother. The two sisters could not have been more different. My mother cared about clothes, Lena couldn't have cared less. My reserved mother had only one or two close friends. She didn't play cards. Lena belonged to four bridge clubs and seemed to know every woman within 10 blocks of any neighborhood she lived in. My mother couldn't or wouldn't learn to drive. Neither, unfortunately, would I. Lena did the shopping for the whole house and anyone else who needed something. She would travel miles to save 3 cents on a roll of toilet paper. It would drive my mother crazy. Yet as much as they were oil and water, they were very close. Close and so different that they bickered all the time and argued over virtually everything. We were all used to it. We didn't even hear them. Still, years later, when our family left Boston and moved around to other cities, it was Lena who would come with my mother on every move, helping her sister pack and unpack, hang up and put away at each new house. Lena was the salt of the earth, the noisy, loving center of the Seletsky family. My grandmother, until she died, lived with Lena. My bachelor uncles also lived with her. Lena is real and visible to me in my mind to this day. When my father was due to arrive home from his travels, Mother would arrange Jackie's and my hair in braids like coronets over our heads and dress us up in our best clothes. When home on Sundays, Daddy would take us to the local baseball game to watch Nantasket play a neighboring team. I am sure my father would rather have gone alone or with one of my uncles, but Sunday was our day, and my dad patiently taught Jackie and me all about the game. To this day, thanks to him, I love baseball. I'm a Yankees fan now, but then I rooted for the Boston Red Sox. It all sounds very ordinary, doesn't it? Well, it was. The summers were a welcome respite from the quieter, darker days of our winters, and it probably wouldn't have changed drastically through the years. Dad would have continued to eke out a living doing shows wherever he could. I would have gone from public grammar school in Brookline to Brookline High, and then maybe on a scholarship to the state university. I might still be living in Boston. But the Can-Can girls changed our lives forever. 63 cents. You know that expression, my life turned on a dime? Well, ours turned on 63 cents. That's all my father had left in his pocket in 1937 when he took over the lease on what had been an old Greek Orthodox church in Boston and turned it into a nightclub. The club was called the Latin Quarter. It made my father successful, rich, and famous. At the beginning, however, it was a huge gamble. The deconsecrated church at 46 Winchester Street had been the setting for a series of failed ventures, like an expensive club with an Egyptian theme named the Karnak and a Chinese restaurant, but my father had a vision. Boston had its share of nightclubs already. What Boston did not have was an inexpensive nightclub that served a full dinner for under $10 and was naughty enough for grown-ups, but tame enough for families. My father toyed at first with using the Congo as a theme, with lions and tigers painted on the walls and a chorus line of pretend native dancing girls. His next idea was to recreate a more bohemian club, like those in New York's artsy Greenwich Village. But after seeing the new movie Gold Diggers in Paris, starring Rudy Valley as a nightclub owner with a chorus line of American girls transported to Paris, he decided to do the same thing in reverse. He would bring Paris to Boston. What to name his vision? Of course, the perfect name was right there in one of the songs in the film. He would call his nightclub the Latin Quarter. Getting the money together to turn the church into Left Bank Parisian Exotica was a scramble. What if it fails, my mother worried. What then, with 2 young children to support? The bad thing about my father was that he was, by nature, a gambler. The good thing about my father was that he was, by nature, a gambler. He took whatever small amount of money he had saved and put it toward transforming the old church. But that money wasn't nearly enough. No bank would give him a loan for a nightclub, so my father borrowed from everyone he knew, a little here, a little there. Perhaps these friends thought that backing a club would inject a little excitement into their own lives. My mother's family had no spare money to offer, and besides, they were, like my mother, too cautious to be excited by the prospects of a club where my father would be responsible for everything. They passed. But that didn't slow down my father. When the money he'd borrowed from his friends wasn't enough, he bartered and promised and begged for credit. For $250 and a promise of $500 more, he sweet-talked some local artists into painting wall murals of Parisian cafe scenes and girls with watching eyes, as my father described them, black-haired, slit-skirted, French prostitute-looking. He bought discarded tables and chairs from the Salvation Army, had tablecloths made of cheap red and white gingham, and weeks before the opening, began melting candles around the necks of empty wine bottles to give the club the feel of a French cafe. My father knew everyone in town by that time. He was well-liked, and after calling his old patron and friend, Joe Tumulty, Boston's police commissioner, who in turn called his close friend, Governor James Michael Curley, my father got a liquor license. He also managed to hire a head waiter who had a following and a club manager, a very bright young man with red hair named Eddie Risman, who would stay with my father for the next 25 years. And so it came to pass that on October 1st, 1937, Lou Walter's Latin Quarter opened. My mother put on one of her few dressy dresses, had her hair done, called for Dodie to come and stay with Jackie and me, and with fear in her eyes but hope in her heart, she joined my father for the opening night of the brand new but old-looking nightclub. Just before the doors opened, the story goes, my father reached into his pocket, took out all the money he then had, 63 cents, and turning to a nearby waiter, handed him the change. "Here," my father said, "now I start from scratch." He needn't have worried about his next 63 cents. Boston had never seen anything like it. The Latin Quarter was a smash from day one. There were two shows a night, and even as little girls, Jackie and I went often on weekends. We would sit way in the back of the room at my father's small table. The acts, singers, acrobats, a comedian here and there, changed each week, but the big and constant attraction was what my father billed as Petite Mamselles. This was a chorus line of fresh-faced young girls, recruited, as in the old days, from local dance schools. These shows were the forerunner of the big girly production numbers in Las Vegas decades later. The girls were all good dancers, and every show ended with their doing my father's version of what he considered a French can-can. With whoops of ooh-la-la, they danced and pranced around the stage, kicking in unison as they raised their multicolored ruffled skirts with their many petticoats. For the finale, they would shout even louder and drop one by one into a deep split, raising their skirts over their heads and showing their ruffled panties. Can-can, indeed. If it wasn't authentic, the Bostonians sure didn't know the difference, and the dance became the trademark ending for almost all of my father's future shows. Give me a glass or two of wine now, and I'll sing the theme song that opened every show. It began, "So this is Gay Paris, come on along with me, we're stepping out to sea, the Latin Quarter. Put on your old beret, let's sing the Marseillaise, and put our wine away like water." We were soon able to move to a much bigger apartment on a much more fashionable street. We even had a maid named Catherine, a funny young Irish girl who had a favorite saying when things got too much for her. "Someday," she would say to my mother, "I'm going to wake up and find myself dead." "Not today, though, Catherine," my mother would always reply. These were much happier days for my parents. There was money to be spent, probably for the first time since I was born. My father's success spilled over to other members of her family. My Uncle Max was on the payroll full-time. He was a confirmed bachelor, but now a successful, much-desired confirmed bachelor. My father was definitely on another roll. The Latin Quarter grossed $750,000 in its first season, and he began looking for new venues. The first, and to me now the most incomprehensible, was at a small resort in Falmouth, Massachusetts, called Old Silver Beach. Air conditioning was a relatively new luxury in the late 30s, causing the Latin Quarter in Boston to close for the months of July and August. So my father followed the summer audience to this resort town on Cape Cod, where on Sunday afternoons and evenings, he staged shows in a Howard Johnson's-type restaurant right on the beach. One part of the building was the nightclub and the other a fast-food restaurant with a counter serving hamburgers, hot dogs, and ice cream cones. My memories of those shows seem surreal, people in bathing suits eating hot dogs and watching the can-can dancers. I missed Nantasket and the family summers there, but our cottage in Falmouth was right across the street from the club, so I had more time with my mother and I could hang out a bit with the chorus girls. My sister, in particular, loved being with the girls, who were very kind to her. I also got to see more of my father during this weird period of the Latin Quarter by the sea. He still stayed out late, dealing with the details of the club and planning the September reopening of the Latin Quarter in Boston. But I would see him midday when I was having lunch and he was having breakfast. His nocturnal rhythms became a family joke. My cousin Selig came to visit us and had been there several days when he chanced upon my father having breakfast at noon. "How nice to see you," my father said to him. "When are you coming to stay with us?" But staying anywhere for any length of time became an increasingly elusive quality for my family. My father's vision for the Latin Quarter was not confined to Boston or to Falmouth. He had thoughts of Latin Quarters all over the country. I realize now that he was a true impresario, brimming with talent and creativity. But I certainly didn't feel appreciative of his talents when, some months after we returned to Brookline and I was once more settled into the Lawrence School, my father announced that we were moving again. And not to yet another apartment or house or anywhere in Brookline. This time, in the middle of my fifth grade year, we were heading to Miami. The Pistachio Greenhouse. On a cold November day, we said goodbye to Brookline. We left my small public school and my teachers, who had known me since kindergarten. We left our pretty, cozy apartment. We hugged and kissed Grandma, Aunt Lena, Uncle Sidney, and my cousins, Selig and Alvin, and off we went to Miami Beach to live in the hugest mansion I had ever seen in all of my young years. What's more, the mansion was green, pistachio green, just like the ice cream. This humongous house was on 5 beautiful acres of hibiscus, bougainvillea, and palm trees, 15 rooms, right on the water, with an honest-to-God swimming pool. I not only had my own bedroom, I had my own playroom. It was fantastic in the true sense of the word. The only thing was, it was in the middle of nowhere. The pistachio house, you see, was on a tiny artificially made strip of land called Palm Island. It was guarded by a security gate and reachable only by a causeway that connected the two cities of Miami and Miami Beach. There were few other houses on Palm Island then, though now it's jammed. One house was owned by Al Capone, the notorious gangster who lived just down the street. There seemed to be no other kids on the island. At first, I was very lonely. I missed Brookline, who needed this huge ice cream-colored house. The reason we were there was the even bigger, white, shiny building across the street, the Palm Island Club. The building, which has since been demolished and the grounds turned into a public park, had housed a famous nightclub and casino until the late 30s when gambling was outlawed and the casino club went bankrupt. Enter my father. It was love at first sight. Not only did the dozen steps leading to the Palm Island Club's marble entrance make it look like a nightclub movie set, the building came fully equipped with a state-of-the-art kitchen, cutlery, china, tables, chairs, everything except linens. There was seating for 600, three times the capacity of the Boston Latin Quarter. dormitories for the dancers, a 10-room house for the management staff, and, across the street, the Pistachio Mansion.